Michael Cathcart with you. Welcome to a glorious new week of Books and Arts Daily here on RN. Today we've got quite a lot to say about drama. In a moment we'll look at the place of drama in the school curriculum, and then later in the show an ambitious new play all about the very intense relationship between Sydney's most famous Aborigine, Bennelong, and Governor Arthur Phillip, which leads us very nicely into the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jane Smiley, who writes about the intimate relationships, or intimate relationships, as a way of understanding how the wider society functions, although she's reluctant to say that she's telling the American story.
I definitely wanted to narrate this book from the points of view of lots of different characters. I wanted to give the smaller picture and have that all add up to a larger picture, because that's the way I think that people experience history.
Oh yes, it's good to be with you on RN this Monday.
We do want to see a less crowded curriculum, particularly in the primary school years. The review finds that there's a great deal of breadth, but not nearly enough depth in areas like, for example, literacy and numeracy.
That's Christopher Pyne, the Federal Minister for Education, launching the review of the national curriculum and the government's response to that. So this review is a pretty hefty document. It's about 300 pages. It's a big thing. And it was compiled after gathering lots of submissions and consultations and so on. And if Christopher Pyne is able to sell it at the Education Council of State and Territory Education Ministers in a few weeks' time, this will replace the previous national plan, which had barely been announced before there was a change of government. So the authors of this review say that they're slimming down an overcrowded curriculum and that they've designed it to be more teacher-friendly, more pupil-friendly, more parent-friendly. The review says that the arts are crucial and that they should not be an ancillary or add-on component. So let's look at the detail of what this review recommends and what does it mean for Australian school children and for their teachers and their parents, I guess. Now, we invited Dr. Kevin Donnelly, who's one of the key authors of the review, to come along to the show today, but he declined, saying he couldn't discuss it until after the state's meeting in December. But joining us now is Robin Ewing, who is a professor of teacher education and the arts. She's also acting pro-dean at the University of Sydney, and she joins us right now. Hi, Robin.
Good morning, Michael.
Now, for those who came in late, perhaps we'd better explain ever so briefly what the national curriculum is.
Yes, well, the national curriculum is an attempt by the Rudd government and subsequent governments to bring us all into line with one intended curriculum in each of the different key learning areas: English, math, science, geography, history, the arts, etc.
So, of course, education is ultimately a state matter.
Well, exactly.
So you have the states deciding what will be taught. But this is an attempt to bring about a kind of national coherence or national continuity between one state and another.
Yes.
Okay, so we had this curriculum that was set up. It was proposed, not implemented yet. The Liberals came in. They set up this review, which has now been published. In brief, what does it say about the place of arts education in this broader national curriculum?
Well, while it definitely does agree that the arts are very important in the curriculum, and it does address the need for more professional learning for teachers in the arts and more resourcing needed, on the other hand, it actually limits what has been set up to date. So, to date, we have a national arts curriculum that looks at the five different art forms, distinct in their own right, with their own skills and knowledges, understandings, etc. Distinct but interrelated.
I'll just cut in on you, Robin. So,
sure.
So the original plan was for the kids actually to study dance, drama,
yes,
visual arts,
music
and media arts. These are all going to be part of the curriculum. Now,
critics
say, wow, that sounds like terrific in theory, but that's very, very ambitious. How are you going to put all that into a curriculum? Perhaps we should just focus on one or two arts, make them the essential ones, and then give students who want to the opportunity to explore more broadly.
Well, that's exactly right. They actually are recommending in their review that music and art, visual art, be core and that the other forms be electives. And I think that is a very retrograde step, because I think all children should be entitled to have the quality experiences in all art forms. And I'd also like to make the point that literature and the literary arts should also always be seen as part of the arts. They're not in the arts document. They have, of course, an important role in English. But the important thing is about, I think, bringing all of these together in relevant and meaningful ways, not in silos. And I think that would go some way to not thinking about ever crowding the curriculum out.
There are two issues here, it seems to me, Robin. One is, do we want to provide training in all the arts for kids, or can we limit them in some way to make the curriculum more manageable? And you've put your view there. The other concern that's around is whether this review that the Liberals commissioned was a return to the culture wars, whether we were now going to have a situation in which there was a Labor curriculum loaded with Labor-type values that was being replaced by a Liberal curriculum loaded with Liberal-type values, and this football could just go back and forward forever. Now, as you read the review, is it as politically charged as some people were apprehensive it would be?
No, in a sense, I don't think it's as politically charged as it is conservatively or traditionally charged, in a sense. So it makes a number of references to the need to go back to the basics, for example, and to concentrate on literacy and numeracy in the first years of schooling. And I guess my concern about that is that the arts are indeed very much part of the basics. They are part of who we are as human beings. We're born with that desire to sing and dance and play and paint and draw, etc. And I think it's also very linked to who we are as creative individuals. To cut that off and to say, well, we're just going to concentrate on this first, is, I think, not looking at the research that talks very much about how important the processes that you engage in when you engage in any of the art forms, and that's not to take away from what I said earlier about them being distinct, but they all have, you know, features like play, design, experimentation, exploration, provocation, etc.
So you're saying when we go into a junior class, we want to see kids painting and dancing and being creative, not sitting down grimly learning to add up and spell.
Well, they will still learn to add up and spell. I'm saying that these are other forms of making meaning. So what I'm really saying is that there are other forms of literacies, and that we shouldn't limit what we think literacy is to, you know, phonics, spelling. They're important, but they're only part of the story. It's also being able to understand in a deep and meaningful way what the story is about. And sometimes things like drama and dance will help us unpack that in a way that simply reading something can't.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and we're looking at the review of the national curriculum, that is the Liberals' response to the Labor plan. And Robin Ewing is with me, who's Professor of Teacher Education and the Arts, and she's also acting pro-dean at the University of Sydney. The review makes the point that drama and dance require resources that many schools simply don't have, that you know that if you're a generalised teacher, you can't just go in and run a drama class or teach kids to dance, that realistically those resources just aren't there. So you would be setting up schools to fail if you required them all to teach drama and to teach dance.
Well, I'm afraid we're already failing, Michael. There's been two national reviews of the way that both music and visual arts are taught in schools, and while we have cutting-edge state-of-the-art at some schools, there is a dearth in others, and that's partly because over time we have provided less and less resourcing and professional learning for teachers, early childhood to primary and secondary teachers in the other areas. Certainly some secondary teachers, if they're going to be teaching the arts, have those specialisations. But the other thing is, we're not suggesting that everyone will become an expert in these areas. What we're suggesting is that they will be able to introduce and scaffold and guide children to explore these different art forms. But you can't, you're right, you can't do that unless you have the professional learning and the resources to do it. Just to say, well, we're going to cut it because, you know, we haven't, it's going to cost, is a really, again, very backward way of looking at things when we know from the research that those children who engage in quality arts experiences will, one, be much more socially and emotionally well, but also that they will do much better academically. Those children in the States who've been followed into adulthood are also much more well-adjusted human beings who engage much more in community service. So even if you look at the economic side of things, you must see that investing in professional learning for teachers, resources in the arts, is a way forward for us all. It's win-win.
Robin, we're talking though as though there isn't going to be any art. There is going to be art, and there's going to be music, and there's going to be visual art, and that's going to be a compulsory part of the curriculum. Now,
well, you see, I think that's great that that's going to be there, but I don't think that's enough. My own area is literature and drama, and there's a huge amount of work done on how the dramatic processes and walking in other people's shoes, etc., can really help children develop, you know, a whole range of understandings that they wouldn't get. So I think it's really sad if we pit one art form against another. I want to make the argument very strongly that all of the art forms need to be there in their own right and not just set privilege two and say, oh, the others can be electives.
But it is a step forward. I mean, look, it's over 20 years since I was a school teacher, but I can remember going into a school teacher the first time I went to a high school to teach, and I was asked to take a music class, and really the music room was just a classroom with a cupboard that had a few broken tambourines in it. I mean,
music and visual arts have always been compulsory, Michael.
Yes.
That's my point. The others need to have that entitlement as well. Since I've been a teacher, which is a long time.
So you're saying this is not
always mandated. So that's no different to what we had before.
Okay, so it's not an advance.
No, okay. It's going backwards.
I see. All right. So let's be clear about what year levels we're talking about in the current system. In the review as it now stands.
Yes.
At what year levels will these will music and visual art be compulsory, and what options will be available under the review as it now stands?
Well, the review recommendations suggest that core visual arts and music be introduced from year three. That it's saying that certainly those other art forms might be part of what's happening in foundation to year two, but they'll be introduced as core in year three.
Okay.
You know what happens when you say, well, these things are core and these things are elective. The elective things often get left out.
Yes, and if you don't manage it properly, the elective things end up being the things that you send the kids to who aren't good at
That's
the
right.
central academic.
Can I also make the point that we also know that those children from more socioeconomic affluent backgrounds will still have extracurricular arts experiences because their parents will be able to afford it. But even though we know how important it is for all children, unless we introduce all of those things to children at those children at school, they won't necessarily have those experiences in the same way. So again, you know, they will be, I think, disadvantaged by not having those opportunities.
Robin, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Michael.
Professor Robin Ewing talking to us there on Books and Arts Daily about the new curriculum. Well, let's continue that discussion in just a moment. Yes, let's open up the discussion now, or focus a little more actually, at what role arts organisations will have in making this new curriculum a reality. And I thought we'd look at theatre this morning. Some children will choose theatre studies as a subject at senior secondary school because it will be an option. But where does that leave children who don't actually study theatre? Now, a provocative paper suggests that theatre companies might have to step in here, but I wonder whether they're up to the task. And I think the authors are taking the view that there are some question marks over that readiness of the theatre companies to do this job. With me are Meg Upton, who's an arts educator, consultant and researcher. Meg, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
And Naomi Edwards is Assistant Director of Opera Australia. She's an arts educator as well.
Oh, good morning, Michael.
And they've written a platform paper. This is this regular series that's published by Currency House. It comes out, I think, once every 3 months. They're fantastic. All sorts of issues are debated. So this one's all about education and the arts. It's called Creativity and the Promised New Order. So, Meg, you claim that most performing arts companies don't take their education programs anywhere as seriously as they could. What's wrong?
They're very much, if I follow on from Robin's comment, there's an ancillary nature to education programs that I think exists in theatre companies. So as arts tends to be ancillary to education, I feel that education tends to be ancillary to arts organisations.
Well, you can understand why. They've got their hands full putting on the latest production by Joanna Murray Smith or
Henny Rayson, perhaps.
Well, okay. Or, or a new play by, you know, a new version of something from the Greeks. But so you can understand why the kids would be a secondary thing.
Because I don't understand that at all. I don't understand why the act of programming a work doesn't automatically consider the young people who are going to be potentially being in that building and what their experience is going to be.
Naomi?
I agree. I think that there's a real thought in programming that focuses on a particular idea of who a demographic might be, and without embracing from a programming point of view, but then also a way of structuring education programs to bring young people into the work that is programmed.
You know, the line that sticks with me from this paper is this idea that, no, we're not preparing the audience of the future, which is, I'm afraid, is what I've always said. We've got to create lay the groundwork for the audience of the future. But you make the point, no, the kids are the audience of now.
Well, that works on the assumption that subscribers are subscribers and will always be the age that they currently are.
Extremely elderly.
And they fall asleep.
When in actual fact, you know, a theatre is open to all age groups, and some of the most exciting work in the world at the moment is in infant theatre.
Of course, it's so obvious once you say it. Yes. I feel ashamed that I've ever said we should be cultivating the audience of the future. We've got to get the kids in right now.
Unfortunately, though, Michael, that's how I think many theatre companies or producing companies think, is that we are bring them in, give them an arts experience, and then we'll have our audiences of the future.
Not anymore. We've changed their mind.
They're way too simplistic.
They're all crowded around their radios as they are every morning listening to Books and Arts Daily.
If it was only that easy, Michael. Yeah.
They're at the STC and the MTC and over there at Swan and Black Swan. They're all listening, taking notes. Don't worry about that.
Please.
So are you detecting any apprehension or apprehensiveness among the theatre companies about these changes?
In changes in the arts curriculum?
Yeah.
To be honest, I notice in the actual review, the 13 pages or the 10 pages devoted to the arts, that there's been submissions from major performing arts groups. And one of the things that I have a concern about is I'm waiting for some really strident voices from the arts and cultural community to be speaking. If we take a music example, Richard Gill has been an advocate and lobbyist for music education in this country for a very long time. And I'm really waiting for our cultural leaders to step up and say, hang on a sec.
And another generation, because Richard Gill's getting on a bit.
Well, he is, and he's, you know, he's hopefully passing the baton to others. But, yeah, absolutely, where are both our young and our emerging, our mid and our late career?
Not that
cultures.
We're implying, Richard, that you should give up.
Yes, we do love Richard.
Hang on forever, as far as
I'm concerned. But where are they, and where are their voices in this debate?
Yeah. So what happens in the theatre company? Classically, what happens in providing experiences for children? What do they do?
I think it depends on the vision of that particular education department. A very easy solution is providing framing devices for the program that sits. So whether you turn up and have some kind of introductory talk before you see a major production, there's teacher notes prepared, there's but on the other hand, there's programs that actually use the skills and talents of artists, be they actors or designers, to further other agendas. And I point to something like school drama run through the Sydney Theatre Company, which is sending actors into primary schools to help teachers teach literacy through drama processes.
When you're at school, it is massively exciting when a top-class actor comes to your school, or actually artist in any form.
Yep.
I mean, I can remember my life really being changed by hearing a man who was a world-class recorder player. Mm-hmm. As simple as that, coming to our school, because, you know, your kids playing the recorder, they go, it sounds like that. And suddenly here comes this man who can play like a god.
Yep.
And you think, oh, my Lord, that little wooden tube, which are all making these horrible noises where they can sound ethereal.
And I think that's the thing for me, is that the moments that can change a child's life are instant. They can be the tiniest experience, and they are indelible. So I think that, coming back to your question about what are theatre companies doing, I think they underestimate how much impact they can actually have in the programs that they run and the value of them.
And both in an in-school incursion context, but we really champion the opening of the door, the huge symbolic gestures that we want theatre companies to make in a much broader way, come into our building, come into our company and participate in the art-making that we're engaging in.
But as we know, the issue always is who's going to pay for it. You're
absolutely right. And there's a bottom line, and theatre is also a commercial enterprise, and it needs to make money, and it needs to exist, and it needs to. But I think the companies that are if I look at MTSE, who actively went after a large endowment, so they've now got a great partnership going with the Crown Resort, but they did that totally to tether that money to an education program and to develop their engagement with that sector. So it's very purposeful, and it is about saying this is an investment not only for us as an arts organisation, but for the people who are putting up the money, and saying this is an investment in the future of not only the theatre companies and the art form itself, but in the future of lots and lots and lots of young Australians.
So that's a good news story.
It's a great news story. And that's, I suppose, if you're going for money, what are you going for? And what's it going to be applied to within the company? So I think those are some questions that I think are really big ones for theatre companies.
Now, Naomi, I know that you're in rehearsal at the moment with Opera Australia. You're assistant director presenting Don Pasquale, which is Donizetti's comedy about a 19th century Roman man who's trying to arrange a marriage for his nephew. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So we're presenting this to a primary school audience.
No, we're not. My other work with Opera Australia is directing the school's company work, which is sending shortened versions of operas out into primary schools, and they reach about 80,000 children a year. Yes, I work across main stage theatre and
I see. I've got your two
stuff.
Projects muddled. So what are you presenting to? So I see. I thought it was an inappropriate story.
Oh, no, it's good. No, well, that's actually the challenge of how you, with inside the Opera Australia program, it's finding a way to bring the canon and the sort of seminal works to a primary school audience. Most recently, I've done an adaptation of La Cenerentola, the Cinderella story, and that's toured Victorian schools this year, and we're tour New South Wales schools next year.
Right. All right, so that's about bringing opera to kids, and it's saying opera is not a scary, old-fashioned art form. It's something you can relate to.
Absolutely, and for most children, it'll be the first time that they've heard live performance in the first instance, and particularly in opera, hearing an unamplified voice coming back to your recording.
And is there resistance among children to opera? Because it is seen as a sort of funny, old-fashioned kind of art form.
They don't know that yet.
They haven't heard that.
Those barriers yet, and it's only later on that the notions of class and elitism kicks in around it. If you can get a five-year-old singing Figaro in the playground, which we manage to do quite regularly, then all of those barriers are dissolved before they even exist.
Well, this is sounding good.
Yeah.
Which is why we wrote the paper, because we can see what is, like, as I freelance across a range of companies, as does Meg, and we can see the potentials, and I guess what we're arguing for in the paper, that at a management and structural level, that the theatre companies see that and back it.
So let's workshop a few other programs, a few other events that an education program in theatre could provide. What would that look like?
I guess one of the things that I think, if I go back to the curriculum review, I'm sorry, and the way they talk about arts as an education, they talk about it in terms of bringing out artists. But arts education is not all about that. So it's also about learning to be an audience, because we all do need to learn to be an audience. I guess for me, the best programs are those that, yes, go out to schools and do and have children singing opera, and I think that's brilliant. And I think adults.
So drawing a contrast between the making of theatre.
Yeah, the making of theatre.
And then the looking at
and
theatre.
And the looking at theatre. And they go together. And so good. For example, there are programs running in some companies, both within this country and internationally, where young people come in and they're treated as art makers and they engage in the art making process. They make theatrical work and they present it in that building. And then they are, I suppose, honoured by that company as being art makers of now, which, of course, is an engagement process in the work that the company itself is probably making. So it's about honouring and valuing young people as arts makers. And I think you also get amazing audiences from that as well, because yeah. the kids become savvy and switched on, they engage, they invest. In fact, I think when I sit in young audiences of young people who I know have had really great, strong arts education, they are so much more active, involved, invested audiences than subscribers are.
Yes.
I'm sorry, subscribers.
In fact, I mean, just to end on a personal note, I guess the fact that I did drama at school and I did music at school, I didn't end up as an actor or as a professional musician, but I enjoy going to those things because I've seen it from the inside. So it's learning how to be an audience. It's an important point to make. Look, thank you for both coming in. It's a terrific paper. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It deals with all sorts of very meaty issues, and we touched on some of them here, Meg Upton and Naomi Edwards. And if you're in Melbourne, there'll be a launch of their Currency House platform paper. It's number 41. Jeepers, creepers, 41 they've produced. It's called Education in the Arts, Creativity in the Promised New Order. And there'll be a public debate, which I expect will be very vigorous. Now, this is at the Malthouse this coming Wednesday at 6:45. That's a quarter to seven. But you have to book.
5:45.
Oh, 5:45. Okay, at 5:45, a quarter to six. But you do have to book for that. Don't just roll up.
And it's sold out.
Oh, it's sold out.
But I'm sure people can come.
All right. You'll have to talk to people about how good it was afterwards.
Particularly anyone under 18. Come along.
Yes, please.
We have to stop. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Michael. Bye.
Across Australia, this is Books and Arts Daily. I'm Michael Cathcart. Well, in 1788, the curtain opened on one of the great dramas of Australian history. This is on the shores of Sydney Harbour. The ancient lands of the Eora people were taken from them, or they were gradually taken from them over the following decades, and a new and quite remarkable settlement began to take shape in their traditional lands. Now, this is the setting for a new play that's called 1790, A Tale Not Often Told, which dramatises the very warm and complex relationship between the colony's first governor, who, of course, was, as we all know, because we've been to school, we've studied in the curriculum, Arthur Phillip, and the most famous of the Eora people, who we should also know, is Bennelong. Of course, he's famous because Sydney Opera House now stands on the land which bears his name, Bennelong Point. So the writer of this play is a first-time playwright, Robert Thompson. He joins us now. Hello, Robert.
Hello, I'm here.
Well, good to have you. I'm relieved about that. And it's also a relief because you are over 80. This is your first play.
Not quite over 80. Kelly was a little bit aging me a little bit prematurely.
Uh-huh. Well, you're in your 70s.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. What gave you the idea to write this play, Robert?
Oh, it goes back a long way to 1989. I saw a play, Our Country's Good, and I thought there was more to this story than came out in that play. And, of course, the more I delved into it, the greater, the more I was fascinated by what was actually going on. It was a most unusual start for, the actual bridging of the cultural gap absolutely staggered me. I thought that man, that leader, has got to be to manage that. Is really something worth recording.
Yeah, well, Governor Arthur Phillip on one side and the Eora people on the other.
On the other,
achieved
right.
something extraordinary on the banks of Sydney.
My word, they did. Mm, yeah, both of them. Mm.
Now, you're in a studio in Sydney. I'm not in Sydney, so this is a little bit surreal. There are five people in the studio, so let's see if we can make this work. Three of the actors are with you. Lazarus is with us. Lazarus
Hello.
Ratua, is that how I say your name?
Yeah, Ratueri.
Ratueri.
Yeah, that's close.
No, let's get it absolutely right. Lazarus Ratueri.
That's
so
correct.
You play Bennelong. Who do you reckon Bennelong was?
Well, Bennelong, he was a inspirational leader for the people. He was very confident and courageous. He was a bit of a larrikin too. And he was sort of the main one to facilitate the partnership, and he was more intrigued, and he sort of cared for the other people and their arrival.
And who do you think he reckoned Governor Phillip was?
I think he saw Governor Phillip as a person that they could really, befriend and sort of make friends with and sort of perhaps move towards a future with, whether that be with the land or, socially and in community. I think he saw him as a good friend and
So he's a sort of diplomat, is he? He's engaging in diplomacy on behalf of the Eora people. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, yeah, completely, completely. He really built that bridge, and he tried to, but not everybody was willing to cross it, if you know what I mean.
Now, Andrew Steele, you play Philip.
I do.
And what do you make of him?
Well, he's a complex guy. He's got a really tricky job. I mean, imagine coming 9 months across the ocean to the other side of the world to a place that nobody's been before, of, you know, anyone that you've known, and you come across these natives who are there, settled in their ways, and he's leading this new colony, and he has to try and make a friendship, an alliance that's going to be really important for, you know, this amazing nation that we know today.
Indians is what they called them, wasn't it? The British called the Aborigines Indians because that's what sort of term they used. Now, Isabella Jessop's with us, and you play Barangaroo, who was, I think, Bennelong's second wife. Is that right?
Yes, that is true. Hi, how are you?
I'm well. And you're an Eora woman?
Me personally?
Yes, you have Eora heritage, don't you?
No, I am from Western Australian heritage.
So I'm sorry.
You're not? Yeah, no, that's okay.
Okay, sorry, got you a bit wrong. So what do you make of all this? What does Barangaroo make
Barangaroo,
of the fact that, that Bennelong's getting so chummy with this white guy?
Yeah, no, she doesn't like it. She is very passionate about her people. She's sort of the female version of Bennelong, if you understand. She's very passionate about her people and very strong-willed and very sort of, I wouldn't say defiant, but, you know, she's...
Bordering,
she knows what she wants.
Bordering on defiant.
Yeah.
Now, we've got two scenes you're going to perform, and I want to get them both in. So let's hear the first one. So I gather the first one is Bennelong and the governor exploring their friendship early on. Is that what's happening here, Lazarus?
Yeah, that's correct. It's Captain Governor Philip. He's trying to sort of spark that initial conversation and grow that relationship. So this is the scene. Governor.
Hello, Bennelong. Are you well?
Bennelong well. How's Governor?
I am weary, Bennelong. The days are long, food is scarce, and there are many hardships upon us.
Is there more food for me? I am very hungry.
I wish I could offer you something. Everyone here is hungry.
Is everyone here a special guest or Governor?
I will try and have you brought something. It is good to see your spirits are so high.
Governor kind to Bennelong, but more food is good.
Are you happy here? We have not yet found your wife, Barangaroo.
Something's good. No tax from Kamaragal. Much safer here. Less chance of spear going in head.
You do have some impressive wounds indeed, Bennelong. These Kamaragal, do you have many conflicts with them? Do you fight them?
I hate Kamaragal. Kamaragal hit Bennelong with spear 2 times. 1 time in arm and 1 time in leg. Even women cause wounds to Bennelong.
They're women.
Bennelong try to take women back after winning big fight. But she bite hand of Bennelong and not let go until I hit her.
That is quite the story. Bennelong, I want you to have this shirt.
Governor, kind to Bennelong. Thank you.
You are most welcome, Bennelong. After all, you are my special guest. Perhaps you can tell me more about the ways of your people in return. Keep our minds off the hunger.
Yeah.
Sane.
Terrific.
Yeah, nicely done. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and we're hearing about the relationship between Bennelong and Governor Philip. That was Lazarus Ratuari playing Bennelong and Andrew Steele playing Philip. Now, Lazarus, you've got Indigenous heritage yourself. I guess there will be some people listening who will find it surprising that you're signing up for this reading of Australian history, because the conventional view is the British came and they, you know, imposed the doctrine of terra nullius on the landscape, on the country, and took the land away from the Aborigines. So why would you have anything positive to say about that process?
What's done is done. I guess as a generation, and to move forward, we have to acknowledge what happened. You know, it is what it was back then. So the more people that understand The more people that are aware and armed with this information, then the quicker we can move on as a country, as a community, as socially, you know. And there are still pockets and parts of this where it's not heard.
Yeah.
So when people understand and know that information, then they won't fear it. So then they won't sort of shy away from it.
Robert Thompson, you wrote the play, and as people will remember from their school days, Governor Phillip was instructed by the British government to treat the Aborigines with amity and kindness, which is a tautology. It just means with kindness and kindness, but there you go. I wonder how you see this process. I mean, do you see the relationships that Phillip was trying to build as a kind of positive way in which colonisation could have proceeded, that was then somehow lost because violence ended up being such a prominent part of the story that followed after Phillip left?
Yes, certainly Phillip was following, and I think that was his natural, humane sort of view of life, to that everyone should get a, have a fair go. So those instructions sort of fitted in with his view of people. He was one of the people of, you might say, one of the enlightened people of the age. It was the Georgian age, and there were not many people could have succeeded in what he did and bridging that gap. There are very few people.
Yeah, he's an inspirational figure in lots of ways.
Yes, my word.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's go to the second scene. Isabella Jessop, you play Barangaroo, Bennelong's second wife. Perhaps you could set the scene up for us. What happens here?
Okay, in this scene, he's just come back to our people after being captured and escaping, finally, from the settlers, and I'm not happy with him.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
Let's take it away.
Living among them, we will always have plenty of food.
Will they always share their food? Have you forgotten that you and Colby were captured by them?
I have not. But while we were there, he treated us as a friend.
You remained captive for so long that we thought you would never come back. It wasn't until you thought that they were running out of food that you escaped. You were weak. Unlike you, Colby escaped straight away, and with shackles on. He became my man while you were away. Keep your two new fat wives and see if they feed you as well as I did.
I've got nothing either. My wives give me nothing. They eat the food they gather. I had more food when I was with the strangers.
Well, is that
scene.
It?
Scene. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, that's powerful. That's telling him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's who she was.
Yeah. Well, look, it's been marvellous to talk to you. I mean, there's all sorts of incidents in this show that you explore. So I guess two of the key events are the terrible smallpox epidemic, which broke out shortly after the whites arrived. And then there's the spearing of Governor Phillip. An amazing incident in 1790 when Phillip and the officers went to a beach at Manly for a meeting with the Eora elders, and one of them steps forward and ceremonially spears the governor. And you just very briefly, that scene's in the play as well.
Yeah, that is. That's one of the climaxes of the play. And the incredible thing about that was that Phillip didn't order retaliation, which is kind of how they can come to form this alliance. Had he retaliated, then friendship with the natives wouldn't have been possible. And that was, you know, accolades to him, and you know, really set up a good foundation for our modern nation.
Well, accolades to everyone who's on the beach that day, because there is the ceremonial spearing, and the soldiers are there with their guns, and the Aborigines are there with their weapons, and actually no one gets seriously hurt.
Yeah, so it really could have kicked off that day, and
extraordinary moment in Australian history. Well, thank you to all of you for coming in. It's been great to meet you, and I hope it all goes terribly well. Chook us for opening night.
Oh, also, Michael, I just want to give a little plug about tickets. If people would like to see the play, it's at Darling Harbour Lendlease Theatre.
All right, I'll do all that okay. Right now. So thank you
terrific.
So much for joining
thank
us.
You, Michael.
We've been talking to the playwright Robert Thompson and the performers Lazarus Ratuere and Andrew Steele and Isabella Jessop. Thank you to all of those for coming in. So the show is called A Tale Not Often Offended. It plays at the Lendlease Theatre at Sydney's Darling Harbour. It's on for three nights, the 13th to the 15th of November. And there's a link to that production on our website. Everything you need to know, you'll find right there. It's called A Tale Not Often Told. That's the title of the show. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN.
Next on All in the Mind, why did this healthy young woman wake up to find herself strapped to a hospital bed?
I believe that I was on television. I believe everyone was out to get me. I was so psychotic. With a test, all came back clean.
So began her terrifying month of madness until her real-life Dr. House came along.
He said, her brain is on fire. Her brain is under attack by her own body.
All in the Mind with me, Lynn Malcolm, today at 1.
That's right here on RN, and you're on RN with Michael Cathcart. So just to clarify, that show is called 1790, A Tale Not Often Told. Well, let's move now to the American novelist and essayist Jane Smiley, who won the Pulitzer Prize for her novel A Thousand Acres. In fact, she's received lots of awards for all sorts of books, including The All True Travels and Adventures of Liddy Newton. Her latest project is a three-volume work. It's the story of a family from Iowa called collectively, that is the three volumes are called, The Last 100 Years. This work stretches from 1920 through to 2020, so 100 years, and it tells the story of Rosanna and Walter, their children and grandchildren. They're a white family, originally from Germany and Ireland and England, who keep circling back to this one farm, to a particular patch of land. The first volume in the trilogy is called Some Luck. It's just been published, and it takes us from 1920 through to 1953. Kate Evans is speaking to Jane Smiley, who is in a studio in London. And Jane begins with the place, with Iowa, the food basket of America.
It's a small town, and it's next to it's an almost city, let's say. It's not a big city or anything like that, but it's a much larger town. And they're very self-conscious about their town. They like their town. And like all small Iowa towns, it has two or three churches and different communities surrounding the churches. And so it's a microcosm of the larger immigrant world in Iowa.
Well, and so Walter and Rosanna seem happy to be there. Do we follow them and their children and grandchildren all through the three books, or will you take us off onto sides? No, so they're the centre?
They are the tree. They're the roots of the tree, and the tree concerns the five, six children that they have, and then the future generations of the family. So they have given rise, or they are the origin of the family, and therefore all the characters. Obviously, the children get married, and they have children of their own, and so characters enter from other families, but it stays focused on this family.
So we meet their children and learn about their character from childhood. Are they all equally interesting to you, or do some, like Frank say, intrigue you more than others?
No, they're all equally interesting to me. I'm their mom. Why would I choose? Why would I have a preference? No, they're all equally interesting to me. They are all distinct in my mind, and I hope in the minds of the reader. And as they grew up, they became more and more distinct to me and more themselves. So I would say, like any mom, that I have a little issues with a few of the ways that they think about things, but they're all equally distinct to me. Well, and it's funny, when I meet people who've read the book, they always have favorites. And they always say, oh, I love Joe, or oh, I love Frank, or isn't Lillian darling, or isn't Henry interesting, you know. And that makes me laugh, because they're characters, but they seem to people like people, kids, whatever.
But that's also because of the way that you build them up for us. And I was interested in the way that you structured the book, because in the first half in particular, the stories are domestic and detailed, and it feels like we're getting the groundwork for the place and the people and getting to know them in a particular way before the rhythm changes and we start to spark off into the world. Did you need to do that to imagine the place, to start off with that level of detail of them as children, as babies, so that we really do build up our sense of your characters?
Well, I have always been interested in babies. You know, I have three children that I gave birth to and then two stepchildren. And the thing that always amazed me about having children was how distinct and individual they were from the day they were born. Just absolutely. And I would read book after book telling me how to raise these children, and I'd say, well, I don't understand this part, the part about how this one is so completely herself, or this one is so completely himself. Nobody mentions this. And so I really wanted to get that into the book.
And they're also telling stories about themselves. Yes. And about each other. So as much as those children have their own characters, they're also having characters that are sort of placed on them. And so Frank, who's a character who I was particularly drawn to, he's defined by his cleverness and his contrariness, but also by the stories other people tell about him. I mean, what is it about him as a character that they want to keep going back to, almost mythologizing?
Well, I think Frank is a little hard for them to understand. He's not like any other person in the family. Walter remembers his own boyhood, where his father was telling him and his brothers what to do all the time, and they did what they could, and they did the best they could. But Frank isn't like that. Frank is more adventurous and more self-willed. And I think every family has somebody, at least a close relative or a distant relative, who just was going to do it their own way, absolutely. And those are interesting people to have as children, because you love their enterprising nature, but you also are scratching your head all the time saying, how, what am I going to do now? How do I keep control of this child? And the answer is, you don't. They go their own way. And for me, that's always been an interesting aspect of being a parent.
Well, and Frank goes his own way by leaving. He goes to Chicago. Yeah. He moves, keeps on moving outwards.
At first they send him to Chicago because there's been so much snow in Iowa that he can't go to school. And he wants to go to school. He likes going to school. He likes learning new things. And so there's so much snow that the school closes down and he can't get there anyway. So they send him off to his Aunt Eloise, who lives in Chicago, and he goes to school there. And so his world broadens, and he does well in school, and he learns things in Chicago that he would never have learned on the farm, one of which is how to swim. He goes and learns how to swim in Lake Michigan.
But there's a section there when he arrives at school that I particularly liked, where you list all the things that he was enjoying about being there. And he was enjoying learning things. He was enjoying everything from algebra to walking down the street. And that happens with a number of your characters. And it seems to me that it's not just about ambition. It's about reading and education.
Yes. Frank is just a curious boy. And I've known, and I have to say that possibly I was like that too, just curious. But he knows he's on his way out. I think he knows from pretty early in his life that the farm is not for him, and he's on his way out, and he just wants to find out how to get there.
And so as he finds out how to get there and the stories about him continue, and we're traveling through your book chronologically, by the second half of the book, as America joins World War II, you say of him, he was drawn to trouble, and this was the biggest trouble in the world.
So, I have to say that he's also running away from trouble. I'm not going to say what it is.
No, we can't give it away.
We can't give it away, but he's interested in conflict. And when he lived in Chicago, he was part of a little gang of boys who got into trouble. And he's interested in conflict, and where now this is a really big conflict, and Frank is one of those guys who's got to go there. I've known those guys in my lifetime. You know, everybody else avoids it, but for Frank, it's something not to be avoided, but to be sought out, just to see what will happen and how you will fit in. And it's more of an adventure than a horror for him.
But it also struck me that this is the way that you like to tell your stories. So we have these huge events, the World War, and we're understanding it both through him in a very sort of particular way, but also in terms of the stories that are told about him, almost sort of reversing the way that people sometimes tell those stories.
Well, this is, I have to say, this is not my family, but I grew up in a family where stories, telling stories was the order of the day. And so you would hear about, my mother was in World War II, and we heard a lot of stories about her adventures in World War II that were personal stories. And then we went on later to learn about the larger issues and the larger picture. But I definitely wanted to tell this book. I wanted to narrate this book in a personal way from the points of view of lots of different characters. I did not want to step back and give the larger picture and then go into the minds of the characters. I wanted to give the smaller picture and have that all add up to a larger picture. Because that's the way I think that people experience history while it's happening.
I'm wondering what claims you're making for this novel, or that perhaps other people will make for you.
I don't know. I'm not making claims for it. I just want it to be readable and interesting for the reader. I'm not going to make any other larger claims for it.
What about the sweep of the century, though? I mean, that's quite a grand thing to do. I mean, are you wanting to tell America's story, or are you seeing it as this family, your imagined family?
That's for the. I think that's a good question, but I think that's for the reader to decide. That's not for me to decide. My plan is to carry this family through the century, but the reader is the one who decides, is this a good picture of the century, or is this a small idiosyncratic picture of the century? First thing that came to me was the title, The Last 100 Years. That's the name of the whole trilogy. And as soon as I had the title, I knew that it was going to move year by year. I thought, okay, we're going to talk about food because that's a really essential way that a culture defines itself. So if we're going to talk about food, then we're going to start in Iowa. And I just started, and I just conceived of the characters and set them on their way. What that adds up to, that's for the reader to decide.
And so you leave us at the end of this book on the edge of all sorts of changes to do with politics and the
yes.
Cold War. How long, then, do we need to wait to see what's going to happen with Rosa and Eloise and Henry?
Till spring. That's volume 2 will be out in the spring. Volume 3 will be out in the fall. So I wanted all the volumes to be published within a year so that the reader wouldn't forget or lose track of what had already happened. And so that's why I've already written all of them, because I wanted them all written so that they could all come out quickly and retain the energy that I felt in them.
Well, I'm very delighted to hear that, because I do want to know what's going to happen to Rosa and Eloise and Henry in particular. Jane Smiley.
Oh, and Henry, I'm glad you liked Henry. I'm very fond of Henry.
Oh, well, from when he was a little boy with his striped suit, he was, you knew he's going to cut a dash, I think.
Yes, I think so.
Jane Smiley, thanks for speaking to us on RN.
Thanks for having me.
Jane Smiley. And volume 1 is called Some Luck. That's volume 1 of The Last 100 Years. And those volumes are going to tumble out, aren't they? I wonder how many writers have done that, written all volumes of a trilogy before they publish it. Anyway, that one's published by Mantle, which is an imprint of Pan Macmillan in Australia. And Jane was talking there to Kate Evans. And there's a longer version of that discussion on our website. Now, tomorrow, the American artist Jeff Koons, the man who brings us inflatable lobsters and a giant puppy made of flowers, we'll meet a critic who believes that these really are major works of art, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. But now we should talk about national parks with Cam Wilson, because Bush Telly is doing what?
Oh, we're looking at whether we get bang for our buck in national parks, what they've achieved over the years.
You mean we go shooting in them, do you? Bang for your buck?
That's actually not what I was getting at. So what have they achieved? What do they cost us? And what are the environmental outcomes that we get as a result? We're dedicating the whole week on Bush Telegraph to looking at national parks. This is to coincide with the Big Parks Congress in Sydney this week. So we start with a bit of history today, the first national park in Australia and why it was designated and what the goals were.
We were pioneers.
Second in the world.
Well, I know the Americans got there first, but we got there pretty close behind.
Yeah, okay. We'll discuss that quickly, though. I want you to know if you know what I'm talking about here. Wouldn't have picked him as a champion. Big Sookie Loose Pizzle Brahman.
I've got no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, stay with us. You'll learn later in the program.
That's Cam Wilson revealing all after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Bye bye. What did he say?
This week on The List, Steve Kilby of The Church talks paisley shirts, heroin and finding humility.
Once I was walking down the street, I didn't have any money, and I found a juicy cigarette button, picked it up and was lighting it. And a homeless man came up to me and said, "Don't do that here, have a proper cigarette." Aww. He pulled out a packet. And that's when you know you're down and out. I was desperate.
That's The List with me, Cassie McCullough, online anytime at the RN website.